Accession number 27084, Reel 11.
So would it be the case that most of the blood on the carpet was not naval blood during this period, or not?
I think that there was a certain, if I can use the word, gunning for the Royal Air Force. That was the area where it seemed that the greatest efficiencies could be made. The Navy, the argument I played is that we have taken the axe to our manpower ever since Options for Change came out, ever since John Knott's Defence Review, and we've been ruthless in pruning down our manpower. The other two services, less so. And so we're quite happy, as it were, to sign up to these things, because we can say we've done most of them. And go on, other two services, you copy us.
In the best of all possible worlds, is that what you wanted to have done, the three services together?
No, I mean, the thing that worries me about, for instance, contractorising all the support jobs ashore, is that you can't rest your sailors in between their bits of sea time, which was, you know, I know it's inefficient to have an able seaman whose duty is fence guarding at HMS Dryad for a year, but actually that is the time that able seaman Snoops actually goes and sees his family and gets home at 4 o'clock. Of course, even the guarding task, which mopped up a justification for a large amount of junior sailors ashore, has been taken over by an MOD guard force. I mean, one moment, we're our own worst enemies. This one moment, one's arguing that sailors want to be getting on with their proper job and not standing at gates and doing these things. But actually, the sailor who is doing the standing at the gate is getting probably some quality home time, even though the job may not be terribly related to his trade.
Is there an equivalent of that in the other two services or not?
Yes, I think a certain amount. Except that the army, of course, you moves around as a battalion, and you tend to rest the battalion rather than the individual. We have to we don't send our sailors around in groups, and so we're into looking after the individual. So we felt with frontline first that we'd done most of the things, and it was a reasonably reasonable exercise to be going, given that the alternatives were worse, which was a reduction in the size of the fleet. Other things that, of course, in size and shape that I had to deal with as First Sea Lord was the future of the Royal Yacht, which was banned by the naval side. And looking back on it, the Prime Minister, I think, mishandled the Royal Yacht thing, because I think that it could have gone much more quietly had he not stalled where the decision could be made, and well, anyway, it wasn't. And so we had all the wrangling about the yacht, and it is sad that it went, but there was no way I could tell the fleet that I was prepared to spend money on manning the yacht and not on manning a frigate. And since the politicians weren't prepared to do it any other way, that was that.
Yes, is it not the case? I mean, this is not the argument that I think that the Navy might put forward, but certainly an argument for the politicians. Is it not the case that the Royal Yacht was a tremendous sales tool?
It was.
I mean, now and again it was abused, possibly, in sending members of the Royal Family off on honeymoon.
Well, no, I think...
but mostly it was a sales tool.
Yes, it was. There was no doubt about it. It achieved a tremendous amount. And I went to a meeting on board the yacht when she came in to the pool, on our last visit to the pool, which was chaired by Robin Butler. And we had everybody who was interested, rather, the chairman of British Invisibles, the people from the city, from industry, and all the rest of it, the export organisations. And we all sat round, had lunch, and then had this discussion of, do we need a Royal Yacht? what's the future of the Royal Yacht, etc., etc. And industry and everybody said, of course we need it, you know, and everybody came up with all these things. The Foreign Office said what an excellent thing it was from the ambassador point of view and thing. And so Robin Butler, quite rightly, said to everybody, and I'm it's not an accurate account of me, but it's all paraphrasing, right, well, gentlemen, where are your checkbooks? Not one was produced. So all the people who had said that weren't prepared to put a penny in. Don Gosling, actually, was prepared to put $5 million down if everybody else would chip in. That offer was rejected. I thought that government actually in the past could have got away with a new Royal Yacht if they were always worried about, you know, public criticism of spending money. If they'd put the contract out to one of the ailing yards in the northeast, have said to every subcomponent, the people who made the engines, the things, and not, if you employ five apprentices, you'll get the contract for this, and you also have a debenture on the use of the thing. Tie as many youth labels, unemployment labels, and things around it, and widen its use a little bit. I think politically they'd have got away with it.
But lack of imagination and lack of political will.
Yes, and the difficulty was that I'm afraid that on that, they weren't getting any active help from me. And I think the yacht was super, but when it comes to a choice between the yacht and a frigate, I had to choose frigate.
Yes, yes, quite right, but then you were being asked to make a choice which you shouldn't have been asked to make.
Yeah, because that's right.
If you're going to use the Royal Yacht mainly as a trade tool,
yes,
then that's a separate matter.
Yes. But anyway, so that was another little hiccup in my time as first.
Can I ask you, if changing the subject here slightly, if Peter Harding's difficulties happened whilst you were a first sea lord?
Yeah.
How did that have an effect upon the four of you, really? Well, we know how it affected him. He resigned, but upon the other three?
Oh, I think we felt sorry for Sheila. I think that wasn't a lot of sympathy for Peter, who the feeling was he'd rather dug his own grave. Remember, I mean, I think the interesting comment was that from the lower deck was fed back to me from various people of what the sailors' reaction was, and the sailors felt that he'd gone below his class in picking Bienvenida. If he'd run away with the Duchess, I think they would have said, "Well done."
What did you think?
It's terribly difficult. I think it was a silly thing to do. He's not the first chief of staff or senior officer to have had an affair. There are lots of people who probably, I suspect, may have remained married to their wife but beat her up each evening. Not quite beat her up, but, you know, be fairly far. I think it's you don't know how people's marriages are really working out. I'm inclined to... I think it's very sad that it happened. Press had a field day. I would feel more sorry for Peter if he hadn't been rather smug about things beforehand, saying, isn't it wonderful, he said, one meeting we had of the Chiefs of Staff, here we are all sitting around the table, not one of us divorced, etc., etc. But he was very naive, I think, Peter, about that. I think, I don't know. Pity.
Thank you for that.
But I certainly think that the Air Force viewed it more severely.
Oh, yes. From what I can gather,
yes.
They do. Definitely.
And not surprisingly.
Just in the short term, what happened to the three of you? Someone had to become chief of the defence staff.
Yes, well, we all went up, and I was hauled into Malcolm Rifkin to be told it wasn't going to be me, and that he'd asked Peter Inge to do it. Well, I think Peter was the, you know, he had the experience, and he had the right thing. And so that was when I decided, well, if we're not going to get it this time, I want to make sure the Navy gets it next time. And I felt, I mean, I could have stayed on and taken my chance, but it was probably better to have Jock running for the thing in the fresh round. I was the Peter Inge, Peter Harding sort of group, and it was clearly, I think people would have switched to the next group of people coming up. So there it was.
Was this still during the era of Buggins's turn?
No.
No, it wasn't.
No, Buggins' turn was broken by Maggie when she appointed John Fieldhouse to succeed
Terry Lewin,
I think. Oh, no, to succeed Dwyn Bramall took over from Terry Lewin, didn't he? I think. Yes, Dwyn took over from Terry, and then it should have been an airman, and in fact John Fieldhouse went in.
Right. So Peter Inge was appointed,
yeah.
And obviously someone came up into the army.
Charles Guthrie took over as CGS, yeah.
Right. And, of course, Michael Graydon continued with his five-year stint.
Yes.
He just bashed on. And so you felt that we are now sometime in 95?
Yes.
And normally, I think, it's about 3 years for a first sea
yes.
board. But you decided to
yes, I mean,
1 year
yes.
spare.
I think, to be fair, that remember, my predecessors had all gone straight from Fleet to, apart from Henry, but, I mean, William Staveley, John Fieldhouse, Julian, had all gone straight from Sink Fleet to First Sea Lord. I'd done 2 years of the VCDS Chief of Staff job in between.
Yes.
So I felt that I'd had my share of working at the Chief of Staff level, and that if I stayed on, it would have thrown the timing. I mean, I think that it would have been wrong for the Navy not to have had Jock as First Sea Lord. And it was difficult. If I'd stayed on to compete for the succession to Peter Inge, it would have knocked him out completely. Well, it's difficult. I don't want to be too sort of too smug about it all, but I mean, I felt it was the right decision, and it really was. I felt that if I couldn't beat Inge this time round, what were my chances of beating whoever it was next time round? So there we are.
And so you left the Navy in mid 95?
In July 95.
July 95.
Yeah.
And you exercised your prerogative and asked Chuck Stater to?
Yeah.
Did you get any, was there any political interest in your appointment? Was there any comment, or was it accepted?
No, I think Jock was, of course, known to ministers as VCDS, and I think they saw him as the natural successor. But there is something which I we'd had a report called the Bett Report, which was into pay and conditions of service in the last few months of my time. Bett had been the personnel director of BT. And came up with a whole lot of ways in which he things would be changed. Some of them were quite on the rating structure and where people should be paid, etc., 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 at what rank. And one of the recommendations he gave was that the five-star rank should disappear. It was inappropriate that the admirals, the fleet, field marshals, and there should go. Malcolm Rifkin, on reading the Bett report and hearing that it hadn't gone down too well in the lower ranks of the armed services, issued a signal which said that, don't worry, chaps, no decision is going to be made about any of these things without the fullest consultation and in-depth studies, and you will be the first to know before a decision is made on a particular thing, etc., etc., etc. And then probably the next day sent round a minute saying he was pocketing the 5-star recommendation. meanwhile, the Naval Secretary had pushed through. I mean, we had this device of promoting the First Sea Lord on his last day of office to Admiral of the Fleet so that he gets an extra 10,000 a year as a really a reward for being head of his service.
That's really its function.
That's its function. People felt that if you've been head of your service and retire, you should have that. Which, of course, now has been accepted in that admirals, the top band of an admiral's pay is exact, more or less the same. And so, anyway, Naval Secretary pushed through my information, all got through the palace and everything. About 6 weeks before I left, I was sent for by Malcolm Rifkin, who said, oh, your promotion to Admiral of the Fleet, he said, I can't let that go through. I said, well, you already have. Oh, he said, and he sent for his private secretary, Margaret Audrey. He said, Margaret, has Admiral Bathurst's promotion to Admiral of the Fleet gone through this office? Have I approved it? Well, the Secretary of State, she said, yes and no. Anyway, we then had ding-dong for 40 minutes. I said, look, the Bett report says that, yes, we should get rid of the 5-star rank, but we should put in a higher level of pension and readjust the Admiral's pay to say that nobody is dips out. You are proposing to cancel my promotion. There is no new system in force, so I don't get my the pension to which I have been entitled to expect. Anyway, we had an argument, and in the end, a few days later, it was all settled, and I was the last. But it was... I only just got in under the door. And, I mean, I don't mind. It's not the rank that matters so much. It really is... The thing is that if the pay structure is such that that's what you expect, I need it. But it was a typical political move. That was the one thing they thought they'd get a few easy brownie points for. Nobody noticed it. Didn't save the country any money.
Well, it saved virtually nothing.
Saved nothing. To be fair, it has probably saved the uniform grant that you get for converting from,
from three rings to four.
Four, yes.
Plus 10,000 a year times three.
Well, no, because the way they adjusted the pay subsequently, it means that the First Sea Lord, as head of his service, goes out on the top band of the pay level, which is roughly the same
as what,
what he would have done as an Admiral of the Fleet.
So the saving is a few £100 or £1,000.
It's minimal.
It's nonsense.
Minimal.
Yes.
But anyway, so that was... we parted friends, and my last board meeting, he went off to be Foreign Secretary and I went off into retirement. Or whatever one calls it on the active list. And so that was that.
Before we finish,
yeah.
And thank you very much indeed for devoting this whole day to this, to your contribution to the Sound Archive, I do, as I indicated earlier, normally ask a very general sort of half-volley question along the lines of the size and shape and state of the Navy today, and whether it is able to meet the commitments which the politicians are putting on it, and whether it is able to be a viable service. We've already answered the manpower question, but I'm sure there are other factors. And I wondered, and also the place of women in the service. Not so much women in the service, but women in onboard ship, in fighting in a situation where they can be killed in action.
Yes.
Which is something...
If I deal with the women at sea first, because I ought to have mentioned it, my time as Sixth Fleet was when, of course, it came in. I think, like all of us, we would rather, at the time, we would rather we hadn't had to go down this route, but we couldn't man the Navy with men only. It was very difficult for Julian to resist Archie Hamilton's argument, well, until you you know, try the other half of the population. You know, don't come to me for more money to increase recruiting of men. You know, you've got to go and put women to sea. If there aren't enough men, well, we'll have women. And anyway, it's a good thing.
And the women, well, we'll come to that in a second, but the women, of course, were paid the same rate, or was there a different rate?
I can't remember. I think there was rough equivalence, yes. I don't think it was too different. I mean, the Wren manning a communication set in the frigate was paid the same as the man doing the same job. I'm fairly certain. I think it was adjusted or whatever. But so it was inevitable that there was to be... I think that they had to go to sea. It was a very brave decision of Julian's to tell the Navy, I think, to get on with it and make it work. And so off they went to sea in, I can't remember which Type 22 it was, and I find myself CNC fleet with a trial ship with women on board. The first murmurs of problems in the Gulf, the first ship that was on standby to go was the one that had women on board. And I sent it off, and I got a call from Julia saying, "Ministers are rather worried that you've sent HMS Brave or Brilliant or whatever it was, because there are women on board. Would it be possible to find another ship?" I said, "Juliet, if we do that, the whole women at sea thing will catastrophically fall dead in the water. Ministers have said that they want this to happen. It's a very good opportunity for them to find out the consequences of their decision." And actually, Julian, was jolly good at read. I mean, he had to ask the question, ministers had told him to. And off they went. I think that in terms of does it work, I'm out of touch now, but it was beginning to work shortly after I left. I remember going around, and I found there was still the old-fashioned attitudes amongst the chief petty officers, but amongst the younger petty officers and everything, they had already, there's quite a quick throughput of people through the Navy, they'd already grown up and joined a Navy in which women and sea were a part of it, so they knew nothing else, and they were much more used to it. Now, I think the majority of chief petty officers have always known women at sea and been in ships with them, and so I think the thing has settled down. We don't get the lurid publicity that the press gave us 10 years ago. Inevitably, from time to time, rather like the headlines of how many pregnant girls were coming back from the Gulf, it will always be a source of fun for the press. I think would we have had it, women at sea, and would there have been this sort of public push in favour of women at sea, which there is, I think, generally, if the first survivors off Sheffield had been women?
Or the first dead casualties off Sheffield had been women.
Yes. Well, I was thinking of that photograph of people coming off with burnt faces.
Exactly.
I think in a way perhaps one might have been able to accept the dead rather than seeing them injured.
Oh, well, possibly.
And would we have been so keen? We have now got used. There was a woman observer who was killed in the Lynx accident out in the Caribbean about 18 months ago, 2 years ago. Americans have had some of their women naval aviators killed. America, I think, seems to take it probably more in their stride than we do. But I think people have probably got used to it. I think we've been lucky that in the Gulf we haven't had any casualties, I don't think, from women.
Well, you see, this is the point. I feel that, I've just merely asked this question, that does having women on board in anything other than a truly token number, like one or two or three, affect the fighting efficiency of the ship? Especially when it's been damaged.
I think this is where we've got to get the balance. There are something that women add value to a ship. I think in the areas of communications, where and the radar, I think they're much more precise and attentive and will concentrate on what they've been told to do and the job in hand. They're very good at that. Obviously, on the medical side, they're very good. I think they probably, although we haven't tested it, may be better in coping with the carnage of naval action than perhaps the men are. They're quite tough. And dealing with a casualty, I believe that the woman will probably, as the first aid party, will deal with the casualty probably as well, if not better, than the man. What the women are not so good at is heaving a huge shore up against the bulkhead when the water's coming in.
Yes.
They'll try, but there is that. So I think getting this balance right between the added value that you get from them doing their jobs equal to the men and possibly in some areas quite a lot better has to be weighed against the need for the physical requirements and the sheer toughness that you need for some of the jobs. And I think we've probably got it about right. But until we've really tested the thing in a Sheffield situation, exactly, we will never know.
No. Right. Okay. The other points
about the future. I think in terms of size and shape, notwithstanding what may come out in the next few weeks, if there is the crisis on the defence budget that we are told in the press, yes, the Navy can still do its job. I think that we are still in theory on tracks to get the new aircraft carriers, and that will, I think, put the Navy in a very strong position. My concern is that George Robertson's white paper and where that has led us, if we lose Blair for one reason or another, but especially perhaps over Iraq, the whole enthusiasm for the government for expeditionary warfare, especially if it's led by an ex-chancellor, is a very easy way of reducing the equipment program. Because at a stroke, you will say, we've learnt our lessons about Iraq, we were wrong, the Prime Minister responsible has gone, and we are not going to get involved in this sort of thing again. Therefore, perhaps we should have another look at exactly what we really do need for defence. And one of the things for sure is that anything that the civil servant, the Treasury civil servant, can tie an expeditionary label round its neck will be for the chop. And I think that I can see that this will be used as a reason for contracting defence. That's my worry. But at the moment, I think given the things that we have to do, whether it's coping with drugs in the Caribbean, supporting operations in the Med off Yugoslav, where there's still ships and in the Gulf, they're still doing the job. I think it must be jolly difficult. They're going on to a new system of manning, I gather, which is so that you can keep your ship. The ship on the whole doesn't mind whether it goes to Portsmouth or Plymouth, it doesn't know. But the ship's company do. And so you've got extra people in the ship, and so you can actually keep your ship running, and then you've got to manage getting the people with their home time and all the rest of it. So that's that may pull us out. But it's jolly difficult. And I think, like all First Sea Lords, there are sort of two things they say afterwards: thank goodness I'm not having to run it now. And the other prayer, which you get on your knees on your first day, is as First Sea Lord, is to say, please God, during my time on watch, don't let the bottom drop out of HMS Belfast.
Sir Benjamin, thank you very, very much indeed. Before we finish, I'd just like to say thank you very much indeed for your contribution today, which has been quite exceptional. But an excellent contribution to the Sound Archive to go alongside the other former First Sea Lords, not allowed to call them retired. I got a letter from Peter Hill Norton telling me I'm not to call him a retired First Sea Lord. Can I just say thank you very, very much indeed. It's been a great pleasure and a privilege to speak with you today.
Thank you very much.